You're listening to America's Most Challenging Issue, where Baha'iTeachings.org interviews community builders across the nation who are inspired by the Baha'i vision of the oneness of humankind. Join us as we explore their work, bringing about racial unity and establishing a more just and equitable society. I'm your host, Masoud Olufani. This is a very personal show for me. In previous episodes of this program, I have unpacked the issue of race in light of the teachings of the Baha'i Faith with scholars, artists, professionals in related fields, and mentors, all of whom continue to make valuable contributions to our collective understanding of the reality of the oneness of humanity. These discussions have necessarily been viewed from the perspective of our guest, with occasional antidotes offered by this host, which, hopefully, enhance the discussion for the listening audience. For this episode, however, I thought it would be interesting to shift the lens just a bit and examine the dynamics of racism through a powerful personal experience, one that occurred in the summer of 1977, when I was an 8-year-old boy traveling across this vast country in my father's blue and gray Cutlass to visit family in California. It was a moment in my life that I shall never forget, not merely because it was my first extended road trip with my dad, but rather because the circumstances of this one experience would awaken me to the social complications of race and arouse within me an enduring determination to help to eradicate the evils of bigotry and injustice. Joining me today for what I know will be an engaging conversation is a very special guest, my dad, Milton John Bowles. For the record, my father is not a Baha'i, and during our discussion, I will quote selections from the faith on the issue of race and invite his perspective. From the Baha'i point of view, truth is one. So whether a person is a Baha'i or not has no bearing on one's ability to acknowledge the scintillating spark of truth when one encounters it. This is a capacity encoded in the spiritual DNA of all humanity. My father draws on a wealth of personal and professional experiences that have informed his views on the issue of race, and I know he will offer some powerful reflections that will inform and inspire. I look forward to learning from him, as I always have, during this very special episode of America's Most Challenging Issue. Dad, welcome to the show. You know, I'd like to begin kind of where I left off in the introduction. You know, all the way back in that summer of 1977, as we were making our way home to Miami from a cross-country road trip to visit family in California. And as I recall, it was late. And you were tired as we were traveling. Of course, you were the only one driving because I was too young. And I remember you falling asleep and me kind of nudging you and kind of trying to get you to stay awake, obviously. I remember pulling over to that rest stop. And I was wondering if you could pick up the story from there and share it with our audience.
Sure. I would be more than happy to do that. We pulled into the rest stop. And this is outside of Jackson, Mississippi. We had just crossed over from Louisiana, and we were headed south going toward I-10. And I was tired. And, of course, throughout that trip, I had depended on you to keep an eye on me and make sure that if you saw me dozing, that you'd kind of give me a nudge. And we pulled over to the rest stop, and you and I both were very sleepy. You were sleeping in the back seat. Of course, in that Cutlass, you could stretch out. So you were stretched out on that seat. And I was sleeping in the front, kind of with my head on the crossed over on the passenger side. And all of a sudden, I felt the car shaking. And of course, I was startled. And when I looked up, the car was completely surrounded by young white males. And of course, during that time, a lot of things went through my mind. I saw Emmett Till. I saw Max Charles Parker. I saw the three freedom riders who had been killed in Mississippi. I saw all of these things in my mind. And so about that time, you woke up and said, Daddy, say, I have to go to the restroom. And I thought to myself, oh, hell, I got to get out and confront these guys. And they, of course, were laughing and going on. And I just said a prayer. And from somewhere deep inside of me, the most amazing thing happened. I felt a sense of calm. And I opened the car door, and you got out, and I got out. And the most amazing thing happened because it opened up like the Red Sea. These guys, they stepped aside, and we just proceeded and walked on to the restroom. And after we finished washing up and everything and completing our visit, we were on our way back to the car. And lo and behold, no one was there. And of course, I just started thanking God for watching over us and keeping us safe. And I got back in the car, and we didn't stop again in Mississippi. We didn't stop until we got to I-10 and headed toward Florida. So that was really it. But it was a test of my faith at that time. And all I had to depend on was God and his protection. And he didn't fail me, as he never has.
You know, Dad, what I remember, you know, most as you're talking about and you're telling this story and thinking about as you were, you know, as you woke up and you saw these white men standing around the vehicle. And of course, you're thinking about Emmett Till. You're thinking about the three civil rights workers that were killed in Mississippi and this history of racial violence visited upon the black body. And what I remember about that moment, you know, looking back all these years later, is how frightened I was. You know, and I couldn't understand why those men, for whatever reason, seemed to derive some kind of sadistic pleasure out of tormenting us that way. And, you know, what were they getting out of it? I don't even think it registered for me that it was about the color of our skin at the time. I mean, I was just confused. It was my first real visceral encounter with racism. And, you know, realizing the complexity, the social complexity of my skin color and what that meant, you know, for me moving in this world. And, you know, I remember that an aspect of the story was, as you said, you know, we walked through the crowd of men. It parted very much like the Red Sea, in a sense, you know. And I remember how calm you were and just how kind of peaceful and placid, and you know, there was no real physical incident or even verbal incident with those men. And you know, of course, many years later, I asked you. I said, "Dad, you know, how are you feeling in that moment?" Because I wanted to know. I was curious, and instinctively, without you know, without even blinking an eye, you said, "Scared." And, you know, of course, you know, these kinds of racial incidents have a long history in America. I mean, you grew up in North Texas during the time of segregation, when the threat of racial violence was very real for the black community. And you've spoken a little bit about it, but I'd like you to go into more detail. I'm wondering about faith, you know, the type of faith that gave you that inner strength to act courageously in spite of the fears that you felt in a very real way.
You know, I've shared this with you before. I was pretty much raised in the church. And from the time I was a little boy, one of the things I used to enjoy most about church was going to Sunday school. And those lessons that were taught in Sunday school, they resonated with me. And I held on to a lot of those stories. As I grew up, I could always fall back on something that I had either read in the Bible or a story or a sermon or something that I heard in church to give me the strength I needed to meet the moment, whatever that may have been. And I held on to that even through my adolescent years on through high school and even as a young adult. And throughout my life. I've always felt, you know, a nearness to God, you know, even in my days when I was running the streets and being a wild young man and sowing my wild oats, doing all of those kinds of things. I never forgot to pray and to thank God. And I tried to do it on a daily basis, even when I would go out sometimes and come in and it'd be 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I'd fall on my knees and I'd have to thank God, you know, for the particular day, for watching over me and blessing me and watching over my family. So that's where it comes from, Masood.
You know, the principal goal of the Baha'i Faith is the eradication of division and the establishment of the oneness of humanity through the teachings of Baha'u'llah, the prophet and founder of the faith. And one of my favorite quotes on this subject states, "In every dispensation, the light of divine guidance has been focused upon one central theme. In this wondrous revelation, this glorious century, the foundation of the faith of God and the distinguishing feature of his law is the consciousness of the oneness of mankind." Now, you've been, you know, you've done some traveling in your life, Pop, and, you know, both nationally and internationally. You know, you interacted with a broad spectrum of human beings in places like the Philippines and Israel. And, you know, speaking about faith and drawing on those experiences, I'm wondering how you interpret this quote and how your understanding of the interconnectedness of humanity has broadened and developed over time.
Well, I had some early exposure. When I was a kid, we interacted with the white community. You had one community, it was the black community, we called it the line. And then we had another community that was a white community, we called it the white line. So you had the black line and the white line. Now, all of the men from both communities worked for the same company. They worked for this plant. And on the black line, we had unpaved streets, and it was one way in, one way out. And houses lined up on each side of the street, and then you came to a dead end. On the white line, you had paved streets. You had houses that had running water and bathrooms inside. We had outhouses, toilets outside. We didn't have any running water inside. We had to get our water from a faucet outside and take it inside, put it on the stove to heat it up. We had to take baths in metal tubs and things of that nature. So early on, I was quite aware of the differences between how white people were perceived in the world and black people were perceived in the world. Now, in my community, we also had some Mexican people who worked for the same plant. They weren't white, they weren't black, they were Mexicans. So what they did was they put them on the black, they were on the black line. And I never will forget one of our neighbors was Mr. Joe Martinez. And Mr. Joe was, you know, an old widower. And he had two sons. He actually had three sons. Two of his sons worked at the plant. But his youngest son, Ricky, I interacted with him quite a bit. He had gone off to war during Korea, come back, and was going to college on his GI Bill. So me and my buddy Harold Jackson used to go over there and look at his sexology books. Ricky would always tell us, you know, hey, you got to go to school. You got to get more education, you know. And so that kind of stuck with us. And my Uncle Buddy, who helped my mother raise my sister and I, he had a friend named Mr. John Pundexter who raised who sold eggs and raised chickens. And he lived on the white line. He was a white gentleman. Well, every Sunday morning, Mr. John would come down and stop, and him and Uncle Buddy would have a cup of coffee and sit at the table and talk politics. And he would deliver the eggs. And I always sat at the foot of those men and listened to their conversations. And that's how I got interested in politics. You know, I'm talking about from the time I was 4 or 5 years old. It made me very aware of the differences But then I knew about this interconnectedness as well, not being conscious of it as a kid, or knowing what to call it. I never felt superior to anyone else, but I didn't feel that they were superior to me as well. I just knew that because I was a Black person, and I regularly heard the N-word being used by people outside of those two communities. Never heard it from any of the white people who lived in the community. The white lived on the white line. Never heard it from them. But once I went outside, say that bubble, if you will, once I heard it all the time. White kids on the school bus riding to and back from school would yell out the windows, you know, and they would say the N word, and it was almost like a chant. So I was aware of that. But it didn't create a hate within me, but it created an awareness within. And in my travels, going to various countries, what I found out, when I went to the Philippines, I was in the Navy, I went to the Philippines, I went to Japan. They always prep you, especially, you know, being a young person in service. They gave you a little book, and this little book said that this particular country favored darker races of people. And that's the way it was in the Philippines. So I, you know, realized at that point in time how different the world viewed America and viewed the people from America, both Black and white. When I went to Israel, I found out when I went to Israel, I had a tour guide, and he took me around to various places. And what I found out was that when the people saw us, they said that the people had returned. And that made a connection for me, because what they were actually saying was that the original people from that land looked like us. And I went down into Jerusalem. There's a place, and I think it's in East Jerusalem, which is that's where the Palestinians are. And there's a place there. And I think it's called Heaven's Gate, if I'm not mistaken. And all of the people that live there look like our relatives, you know, same complexion there. And in talking with them, they had been there for 1,000 years, you know, from one generation after the next. And that just made me consciously aware of a lot of things that I had read. It also helped me to connect myself and our people to the scriptures. I had an opportunity to go out and spend some time with the Ishmaelites. Well, the Ishmaelites are Black people. I mean, you know, I won't say dark race people. They're Black people. They look like us. You know, and I went and I had an opportunity to drink tea with them and interact and converse with them. And they were really no different, you know. We went to a hotel on the tour to have lunch. And as they were preparing to give us lunch, this hotel was run, of course, by Jews who had come there from Eastern Europe and America and other places and settled. We just happened to have a Jew with us who spoke the language. And he was from America. He's from Chicago. I never will forget. The Jews that were serving, who owned the hotel, who was serving us lunch and everything, were speaking in Hebrew, words that I didn't understand. I don't speak Hebrew, but I know words. And this gentleman from Chicago got really upset. And we asked him, why was he so upset? And then he told us that they were saying disrespectful things about us in Hebrew. In other words, calling us names. They didn't call us the N-word, but they had a comparable word for that, which I don't recall the word, but he was on it. And he went and he complained. And so, of course, the service was excellent after that. These are just things and interactions that I had through my travels. But even going through all of that, I still, you know, I love my fellow man. I don't have, I don't harbor any grudges or anything of that nature. I just know that there's a difference between right and wrong.
It's such a powerful, series of stories that you shared. And it's so interesting how this, this legacy, man, of institutionalized racism, which is, you know, baked into the very fiber of this nation, there are so many complexities that have resulted, that have come as a result of that. Relationships between culture groups that, you know, you cultivate over time, that, you know, maybe you establish in your childhood or when you're young, and you're in this kind of bubble, as you said. And then, but the rest of the world imposes this narrative and makes those relationships more complex than they necessarily need to be. It's just really interesting. It reminds me of the story, that other story that you told me and that actually we experienced during our travel, to go and see family in California, and how we made that stop in Texas, man. I remember there was an elderly white man at a barbershop who you wanted to stop and say hello to. It all of that kind of centers around a story from your childhood that I think has deep resonance, particularly about some of the things that we've been talking about so far. And I was wondering if you could share that story and what it was about, this gentleman and that experience that compelled you to want to stop and check in on him.
Well, God has been good to me throughout my life, Masu. And I felt it was an opportunity to share with you some of my history and help you to understand what helped to shape me as a person. I wanted to go and let them know that I appreciated the things that they had done for me. Mr. Harris was one of the gentlemen that I went to see. He was the elderly white man. I think it was three barbers in the shop. One was his son, who we call Bozy. And the other gentleman I didn't know, but I had worked for Mr. Harris, Shining Shoes. He gave me my first job. I wanted to let him know that all was well with me. And let him know that I didn't forget it. I appreciated what he had done. And that's what I expressed to him. I also wanted you to know I didn't harbor any hard feelings against white people. And my relationships were based on how they treated me. And if you respect me, I'm going to respect you as well. And we went to a second barbershop where I also used to shine shoes, and that gentleman's name was Harold. And Harold was, he was a licensed preacher. And I shined shoes in his shop for probably a couple of years. I was young. I was maybe 11, 12 years old at that time. And I recall this one incident that a gentleman came in, and he was a racist. I shined his shoes, and he said, called me the N-word and said, "Let's see you pop that rag and cut a jig." And Harold immediately looked up, and he was in the middle of cutting the man's hair. He said, "Hey," he said, "you don't talk to him like that." He said, "If you have to talk to him like that," he said, "you can leave my shop now." And I never forgot that. And Harold also insulted me. When I say insulted me, he told the man, he said, "He's smart." He said, "He's not like the rest of them." I can laugh about that now, but it was very hurtful to me, because that was put down for the rest of my brothers and sisters when he said that, And I felt that I was no different, and I had friends who were much smarter than I was. And he was kind of grouping us, grouping everybody together and generalizing and separating me out. And, but I never forgot it. I never forgot the fact that he stuck up for me. And I wanted to also let him know that I never forgot him and I appreciate it. And, that all was well with me. So those were the two things that, two experiences that, we had when we were on that particular trip in Texas, dealing with race.
Hey, it's so interesting, Pop, because I think it illustrates a couple of points for me. On the one hand, you know, it indicates this really, Herculean, effort, and this deep well, this deep reservoir, of forgiveness, the capacity to forgive that the Black community has, demonstrated, throughout our long and, treacherous trek, in this, vast wilderness called America. You know, we have, demonstrated to not only America, but to the world, our capacity, to be forgiving. So when these narratives come out, right, about us, being angry and burning things down and, taking revenge on white people, of course, that's from a certain segment of the white population who's afraid of, you know, of the browning of America, of the nation, say things like that, of course, but they're not based on any empirical evidence. We don't have a history of behaving in that way. So that's one point, right? And then the other thing that it really indicates to me is how much the white community has suffered as a result of racism as well, in a different way that we have. But because they've been locked out from this deeper understanding of the interconnectedness of our humanity, their oneness, not as a theory or something that exists in the mind, but in the heart, knowing that we are interconnected, right? They have segregated their history. They've segregated their willingness to be open to the vast contributions that people who don't look like them could make to society as a whole. And as a result, the progress of this nation and of humanity as a whole has slowed down because of this kind of racism, right? That segregates opportunity. So those two points, I think, are really, really something that resonate for me listening to these stories, because I think they indicate, first of all, our capacity at forgiveness, which is a profound gift that the Black community gives to the world. And then also the way that the white community, unbeknownst to themselves, most of them, how much they have suffered because of the institution of white supremacy. So it's just really interesting. It reminds me of a quote from the Baha'i Writings as well, which I think kind of summarizes this notion of our interconnectedness. And it says, "They whose hearts are warmed by the energizing influence of God's creative love cherish his creatures for his sake and recognize in every human face a sign of his reflected glory." And I'm thinking about how easy it is to limit this statement only to those who we deem deserving of it, right? But the quote says that we are to cherish one another for his sake and not because an individual has done anything to merit that consideration. So it's not based on behavior. And this is related to the teaching in the faith that forbids backbiting as the most grievous of sins. Now, this is not easy work, particularly as it refers to the issue of race, right? Which is caused so many long enduring wounds. It's demanding and requires us to draw on spiritual muscles that may need to be strengthened as we strive to manifest this teaching in our behavior. And I'm wondering what spiritual principle you draw on when you're dealing with difficult people. You know, how do you separate the value of a person, which comes from God, it's inherent, right, from their behavior, which may not reflect the divinity of their creation? And I'm wondering how you regulate the very human impulse to repay an offense with an offense and to resist the temptation to speak disparagingly of someone in their absence. You know, spiritual tests that I know I face and I think we all face.
Well, I try not to gossip. And that's really what's being said there in that scripture that you quoted. I try not to gossip about people behind their back, especially in a negative way. There are times, of course, when as human beings, we will fall into that type of activity, which again goes against God's principles. And it's true in many other faiths as well. Because, you know, as people, you can hear one thing, and then you can say it to somebody else, and you'll switch up and change a word or two here. And then if they pass it on, they'll pass it on, and they'll change a word or two. I mean, there have been studies done on that, you know. And before, I mean, and then at the end, it's completely different than the story, the way it started out. So I think that one of the things that we can take from that is that, in a loving and cherished relationship that we have with humankind, that we need to restrain ourselves from engaging in that idle conversation, idle gossip, because it does harm whether we send it to the person's face or not. It does harm because it changes opinions of people without them even knowing it. And sometimes what can happen as a result of that is someone can hold something against you, not necessarily because of something you did to them, but their impression of you, which was created because of gossip. I never will forget once your mother and I were talking, and she was talking about this lady friend of hers that she had on the job, and she was telling me about some of the things that she heard. And I told her, I said, sweetheart, I said, the way you approach that is how they treat you. And her and the lady, they became friends. I met the lady, met her husband, and they were really great people. But sometimes a person can say something that just strikes you the wrong way. And you take that and you run with it, the kind of thing that you want to refrain from so that you can continue to grow, because it stifles your growth.
Yeah, it's so interesting, Dad, because I have learned, man, it's taken a while for me to get to that place, to this place. But I have learned that difficult people, challenging people, are a real gift from God, because they help us to strengthen our spiritual muscles. I mean, I can't develop patience if my patience isn't tested. I can't develop a deep and sincere love if my love is not put to the test. You know, I can't develop courage if I'm not put in the crucible of danger, whether it be physical, mental, spiritual. So, you know, I really have found that those individuals who are difficult, and sometimes we're difficult. I mean, right, like you said, I think you said it so eloquently and so profoundly, is that, you know, this is a journey that we are all on, and hopefully we're all striving to get better on a daily basis. Sometimes we stumble and fall, we pick ourselves up, we go again, and God is forgiving and merciful, you know. Yeah, I mean, I really have grown a deep appreciation for people who have helped me to strengthen my spirituality and my connection and commitment to God. And I never will forget, I remember when I was a kid, you told me when I was younger, and I had been struggling with some things, but you told me, you said, read your Bible and pray. And really, it was that, that lesson, that encouragement that you gave me about my spiritual connection to God, about seeking out the nature of my soul, which really ultimately led me to the Baha'i faith through that deep spiritual search, and then ultimately to the Baha'i faith, and has, been a source of guidance and has given me a real framework for how to live, to try to live a just and morally sounded life, morally sound life. So I want to thank you for that, man. I really do. You know, this has been wonderful, Pop. I think I'm just grateful that we've had an opportunity to sit down and talk today. And we've talked a lot about faith. We've talked you know, a lot about situations that tested that faith. We've talked about the issue of race. And I'm wondering if you have any parting words that you would like to share with the audience. I know you got something, you know, ready to go. I know you got a couple of gems that you could share, but anything that is just sitting on your heart that you could share with me and share with the audience that, you know, can be a source of hope and of strength as we go forward and make this walk through life.
What comes to mind for me is that in this moment in time, we're faced with a lot of challenges. In this country, race is a central issue. What I would say is that everyone needs to just take a moment, step back, and think about the trials and tribulations that they faced in their life and how they came through it. Whether a person is aware spiritually of the fact that God has been there to guide them, to direct them, and bring them through these things, to take a moment to recognize that. I can't point to any particular religion or anything of that nature. What I'm talking about is a spiritual awareness, is that now is a time to really go back and examine that connection that you have with our Father and seek answers through your faith and your spiritual connection to God. We'll get through this. You know, we'll come out on the other end. Hopefully we'll come out for the better. Have a better nation, a better world for all of us. I think we know who wins in the end. We just have to endure until the end through meditation and prayer.
Yeah,
it will get us there.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we have to take action as well. Mm-hmm. Can't just step back. We have to do something. Yeah.
I love that. I love that. I mean, that connection between prayer and action, putting prayers into the field of action. It's wonderful. Thank you, Dad. Hey, man, look, you already know I love you. And I just wanted to tell you how much I appreciate you. And it's been such a blessing to have this journey with you throughout my life. And that continues on. We're still writing this script, right? Yeah, man, I just want to tell you how much I respect you and I love you. So thank you again.
Okay. Love you as well, son. And you make me very, very, very proud, father. Proud to be your dad.
You've been listening to America's Most Challenging Issue. I'm your host, Masoud Olufani. And remember, it's not for him to pride himself who loveth his own country, but rather for him who loveth the whole world. For the earth is but one country, and mankind are its citizens. From the Baha'i Writings, thank you so much for joining us. Until next time.